Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
You hesitated on the eavesdropper. Are you jealous because I own that moniker?
Well, I thought that it would give it a little dramatic impact. Also, I couldn't hear anything out of my headphones, so I was adjusting a knob at the exact same time. A little double duty there.
Because we did spend a whole show, oh gosh, some time back, and maybe it's time to revisit it this summer, about the joys of eavesdropping and you know how you can really experience the richness of life if you just kind of sit in from a distance on other people's interactions. And it's funny because, you know, I was in Chicago last week visiting my daughter, Kelly.
Yeah, that's right. How was that?
It was wonderful. It was kind of a dual experience. So it was my husband's and my 33rd wedding anniversary. And we'd love to see our daughter. That's always a bonus. I love Chicago. And Todd Rundgren had regrouped with Utopia, and you're probably far too young to even know who I'm talking about.
I know who you're talking about.
Okay, good.
I mean, I'm pretty young.
But. Oh, yes, you're trying to get both. But yeah, so Todd Rundgren is like the soundtrack of my childhood. I think I got the Something Anything album when I was 13 years old and listened, you know, went to concerts, his Back to the Bars concert series up in San Francisco when I was in high school. And I got to interview him at the Arlington Theater when I was going to UCSB and writing for the paper. And so this, his music and his mystery and just his essence has been part of my soundtrack all of my life. And he reunited with his one of his bands, Utopia, and they're doing this tour around the country. And the only show we could go to see with timing was in Chicago. So as much as I love my daughter, the real motivation, the ticket purchasing was around getting to see Todd Rundgren. And I have to tell you, it did not disappoint. He's playing at the Wiltern Theater tonight, if anyone wants to jump in their car. His voice is strong. He's almost 70 years old, and he just hits the notes and rocks out. And the audience was all around my age and clearly all jumped into the band Todd Wagon in their teen years. And the groupies of Todd Rundgren are called Hot Toddies.
What?
Which is awesome because I think everyone looked like they would be drinking hot toddies.
I did not know that. That's incredible.
So it was really, really fun. It was good for my mental health to go out and spend the week there. And I was really happy with the show last week, too, because we interviewed Birds of Chicago. So I don't know if anyone caught the connection that I was in Chicago when I was talking to Birds of Chicago last week on the show. And if you didn't hear it, please check out the archives because Tyler gets everything put up quickly. But I thought it was a really fun interview with them and also Raul Pacheco from Ozomatli.
Yeah, it was a cool show. It's over at kcbx.org. Just search for The Reluctant Therapist. Is today's show all about Todd then?
Yeah. Well, as tempted as I would be to make it all about Todd, it's not. But his music is going to the background for the show today.
Cool.
So the songs that you'll be hearing between segments are all Todd Rundgren songs. And if anyone is so inclined and would like to know more about the Todd musical selections, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com and we can chat. But today's show is interesting because I've had this conversation planned for a while. I was contacted by James Statler, who's the executive director at Community Counseling Center, which is over on Marsh Street, because they are celebrating 50 years of providing service to the community and wanted to talk about the program. And I said, that sounds interesting. I'd love to talk about where our mental health treatments have gone or progressed in the last 50 years. So we're talking from 1968 that we've progressed to where we are in 2018. And to talk a little bit about the history of psychotherapy and how we're doing some things well and how we're still struggling in other areas. And then to talk about where James sees the counseling profession going 50 years out. Where are we going to go 50 years from now? Because if you read articles about how psychotherapy is trending, which is disconcerting just in how they write about it as if it's a fashion statement. But it isn't really that odd because if you look at psychotherapies for the last 50 years, there have been a lot of fads, somewhat like fashion trends, things that people have jumped into and jumped out of just as quickly. But looking forward, there's a lot of talk about technology and virtual reality and, you know, more disengaging of people, it seems like, from the one-on-one of therapy and more about finding it on an app or finding it in the virtual world, finding healing. So that seems to be what the most popular trends are. So I'm hoping we'll talk about 50 years out, you know, do we just succumb to becoming automatrons ourselves as human beings? Will we, you know, take our emotional systems and refine them so much that we don't have a wide range of feeling experiences in the world? So I'm curious about that part of the conversation. And the timing is interesting because although we had set up this conversation probably over a month ago, when I came back from Chicago, I was met with some really sad, sad is an understatement, devastating news that I had lost a friend of mine who had struggled with major depressive disorder for the whole 30 years that I had known her, from the time we were moms of young daughters. Our older daughters grew up together, and we hung out, and we watched our kids grow, and we lived in the same neighborhood, but she always struggled with depression. And part of the story that I tell today as the reluctant therapist is based on my experience watching my friend struggle in a system that never really helped her, but tried a lot of experimental things on her, a lot of medications and ECT and different treatments, and never were able to get her back to any sort of stability. It just kept going downhill till she took her own life. And the response of the neighborhood and the community was, we hope she's in a better place because we've watched her struggle for 30 years. And as a clinician, that's not okay for me. That's not okay that that's how we respond, that, well, everyone tried their best and I guess it was never going to get better, because I don't believe that's true. I believe that it's at the very beginning when she was shot down this path of a lot of experimental therapies, it got so deep it was too far to ever come back to it, to a set spot, to a normal that she could start over with. And that's why I always talk about needing to be so careful about the treatments we allow ourselves to partake in, because they aren't benign. When we talk about the psyche and our chemistry and our mental health, you know, there's nothing that we do that is benign. Everything has an impact on us. Everything has an impact on our emotional system, our mental health, our perspectives, our physical being. And so to think really hard before we allow ourselves to go into any sort of treatment. What are the repercussions? What are the side effects? What are the potential dangers? What are the risks I'm willing to take? You know, is there a chance that I'll get better and a chance that it'll get worse? Are you willing to take that chance? You get to make those choices. And it's why it's so important to look for a good clinician before you're in a place of needing a good clinician, because you wouldn't wait till you had a toothache to find a dentist. So you shouldn't wait until you're in distress to find a clinician, because that relationship that you build with this other human being, that trust and rapport, the way they know you in your best state, gives them an idea of how to get you back to this place when you're in times of distress. What is your own normal, in quotation marks, because that whole spectrum of normal is an entirely different show and different conversation. But today I want to focus on, you know, where we've been for 50 years or where we've come from. You know, are we doing better than we were 30 years ago for my friend, or 50 years ago for others who, you know, jumped into counseling, which in 50 years ago was very new. In 1968, we were only 20 years out from Carl Rogers and Adler and the clinicians who came over to the United States after World War II, bringing really forward-thinking ideas about counseling. We're only 20 years into it by 68. And we'd been through a cultural revolution in 68. And we were on the verge of completely disrupting the family structure as we knew it in 1968. And so counseling was barely up on its feet at that time. And then the entire culture exploded from 68 to 78 or 68 to 88. I mean, it just continues to morph. And so this profession that I'm a part of has never really had a long period of stability where it was able to say, here's what we're rooted in. Here's how we help people. And so without having that strong foundation, there's been a lot of misstarts, misfires, and good work, and good discoveries, and people who are finding their way to a better place. Because I don't want to sound like I'm all reluctant therapist all the time, that there is a piece of me, a large part of me, that is proud of the potential of what this profession offers, but really wants people to understand that they need to be wise advocates for themselves. They need to be strong advocates for their mental health and well-being, that we can't just go to someone with letters by their name and expect them to have all the answers. So that's today's conversation. My guest is James Statler. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'll be opening up the phone lines in a bit. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be a part of the show by visiting our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the Programs tab. And you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR One. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe and you can listen at your convenience. But I look forward to opening up this conversation today, seeing where we go. And we're going to get started with a little inspiration from Todd Rundgren. I cannot believe that he starts the show hitting this note at 70 years old. We'll be back to start the show. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and my guest today is James Statler. Just found out that he's also a fellow gaucho.
Go gauchos, I know.
Did we say go gauchos?
Why not? Yeah, right. Gauchos.
UCSB, Thunderdome. And you are also the executive director of the Community Counseling Center, which is on Marsh Street in San Luis Obispo, mm-hmm. For those who aren't familiar. And the mission statement of this center is to build and support emotionally strong families, individuals, and community through confidential, affordable counseling, education, and advocacy. And you're coming up on 50 years of meeting this mission for the community. So, James, let's start off, because we're going to talk about kind of the history of psychotherapy.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit of the history of the Community Counseling Center to kick it off.
Thank you for that.
Why did it get started?
Yeah, let's build a little historical consciousness about Community Counseling Center. So, founded in 1968 as San Luis Obispo County was grappling with the need for treatment for returning Vietnam veterans, what we called shell shock. Also, CMC, the California Men's Colony, was opening about that time, so you had families and reentry members that were coming in the community. And prior to 68, the counseling or therapy needs for people that were low to moderate income or uninsured were being met largely by the pastors or the chaplains in the area. Mm-hmm. The Ministerial Association was able to field those referrals, but as you so sort of eloquently described, 1968 was a flashpoint for a lot of new stressors, new level of awareness and consciousness. And with that, the Ministerial Association sort of threw up their hands and said, you know, we need our clinicians, or we need a profession that can start to address some of these things with some new ideas. So hence what was Family Services Center originally, and the name changed to Community Counseling Center in 2000. But the agency was founded in 68, and the core mission was volunteer professional counselors coming together to provide services for people who couldn't afford it or who didn't qualify for some of the, we'll say, more acute cases that the county might handle.
Which is handled probably through General Hospital at that time?
Right, yeah, it would have been General Hospital up on Johnson. So that mission has been at work now for 50 years, and, you know, in terms of a trajectory, you know, founded in 1968 and housed at a church. In 1970, the local hotline program was actually founded under Community Counseling Center. Now that program is through Transitions Mental Health Association, but it's a local crisis support line that most communities have. In the 80s, we were seeing some of the first AIDS patients in collaboration with Access Support Network. So in terms of the advocacy and kind of working on stigma issues, I think we've always kind of been at the forefront of that, doing work out in the jails, literacy classes and education. In the 90s, we looked to cover more of the county and stretch out to North County, Paso Robles, or the South. In the 2000s, you know, focusing on kids more. We'd largely been an agency that served adults and couples, but trying to get, you know, to our teenagers and even to our younger children. And more recently, we've been working directly with school districts, developing kind of on-campus school-based therapy program to complement the community work. And even more recently, we've tried to adapt to take on Medi-Cal or SenCal insurance to cover the therapy for our clients. Our core program, which has been working for 50 years, is a purely sliding scale program based on net household monthly income, no red tape, very good faith, and a wonderful program that the community has. So I'll invite you to explore that more.
And how is the relationship with Cal Poly? Because the students are always coming to me looking for help and referrals.
Well, we have a strong relationship with Cal Poly for a couple of reasons. First of all, seasonally, we get a lot of referrals in the fall and around the holidays and in the spring as the Cal Poly Health Center clinic's waiting list gets, you know, impacted and they need to refer out for quicker turnaround. So we see the referral flow. And also there's a great pipeline for the master's program, the MFT program that comes out of Cal Poly. We are one of the premier training sites in the county for professional therapists. So we get clients from Cal Poly, and we also are cultivating future providers.
And so when someone comes to the Community Counseling Center, you talk about it being staffed by volunteers. How many volunteer clinicians do you have? And I would imagine they have a wide range of niches, skill sets. So talk a little bit about your list of volunteers and how you match people correctly.
Right now, we have about 100 volunteers. That's across the service area, so across SLO County, even into northern Santa Barbara County. And about 60% of those are licensed, so licensed marriage family therapists, clinical social workers, clinical psychologists. And then the other 30 to 40% are pre-licensed practicum students and associates or interns, both at the master's and the doctoral level. So of those therapists, you're right, there's a lot of niches, right? Some that come with the child, you know, family, youth, and services. Some that are coming with a trauma training, you know, or work with intimate partner violence, domestic violence, child abuse, and neglect. You have a cadre that are very family systems, you know, doing couples work. And
do you have addiction counseling?
So we have some, yeah. I would say just because of the nature of the field. I mean, we have such this co-occurring, you know, situation in our society. However, you know, we have a scope of work. I mean, we're really in a mild to moderate mode. So while we do tackle addiction, if during assessment or the early screening we see that, you know what, substance use disorder is really the primary issue, and, you know, all of the functionality, relationships, education, career are all kind of pointing back to that, and there isn't any sobriety in place, you know, then we're going to ask that person go out and get some primary treatment, you know, for substance use disorder, whether that's at, you know, county or cottage or using their private insurance. And then after some parameters and care have been put in place, you know, therapy with us could be a next step.
Mm-hmm. So kind of working together. And are you able to keep up with the demand or need? Because that seems to be the ongoing problem for Santa Barbara, San Luis, and Monterey County is that we don't have enough services for the need.
That's correct. Well, I would say there's an exploding need. Based on our look at the vital statistics, we think that in San Luis Obispo County, there's at least 20,000 folks who are low to moderate income, maybe underinsured, that would benefit from a mild to moderate therapy. And that means, I mean, we're talking about early intervention. We're not waiting till the big distress hits the platter and crisis is, you know, at every turn. We're talking about folks that would benefit from having this be a part of their, you know, their daily life, their weekly life. So we see about 2,000 clients a year, and that was a new high for us last year. But that's only 10% of that perceived need, and the need's probably larger. So we do need to step up a bit in terms of as we grow programs into the next 50 years, which I think we need to do. We got to build capacity. We got to plan. We got to innovate. How do we do that in a way that's best for our clients?
I think also when we talk about mental health, one of the big struggles is, you know, I'm hearing a lot of conversation in other areas of we need more beds, we need, you know, places with people with critical mental health issues, psychotic breaks to get services, but we somehow lump in the critical need with the transitional need. What the large majority of people need is that temporary help to get through transitions and grief and traumas and low-level depressions or all those things that impact our daily living. Like that, as a clinician, as a psychotherapist, that's 90% of what we do is those daily living things. And so when we talk about serving the community, unfortunately, that would be easier to serve if we could extract the counseling needs from the severe psychiatric needs of the community.
Right. Thank you for that. I mean, not to use an overly pedantic word, but I mean, we conflate those a lot, right? Mm-hmm. We do. And those, you know, sensational to some degree, you know, portrayals of mental health that we see, which are psychosis and violence and tragedy and hospitalizations and all the things that go around that, it doesn't really speak to what we talk about as the continuum of care, or, you know, I like to think of it as the accordion, you know, pull the accordion out and, you know, there's several different ridges and layers to get to one end of the accordion to the other. And we talk about one section a lot, and that's the chronic, the persistent, the crisis. And community counseling center and many other therapists fill that niche of the front and middle end of the continuum, which is the early intervention work and the resiliency building as a preparation for trauma and grief, because that's what life brings.
Right. And I think that's, again, when I think about the struggle of communities or for communities in dealing with everything, you know, we're talking about gun violence. And so we talk about gun violence and we really say it's mentally ill people that do this and, you know, that pull the trigger. And that just continues to cloud the whole idea of mental wellness. And people then are terrified that if they feel depressed or anxious or they're not happy or they've suffered a loss, that somehow now they've entered into this realm of mentally ill, which lumps them in with shooters and people with psychotic breaks. And that terrifies people. And so that terror that we feel of, oh no, my mental health is slipping, makes our mental health worse.
Absolutely.
And then people, you know, by the time they come in for help, are feeling so unstable.
Right.
And they don't have a history with a clinician. And then it gets to the reluctant therapist part of me. We as a profession have become far too quick to pull, I'm not going to say pull the trigger, but that to jump in and diagnose and medicate people who really are struggling with normal responses to the stressors of life. And and so how do you address that as a center? Because there's a lot of pressure coming down from managed care to get these people diagnosed, get them into a medical model treatment. I imagine you have funding that relies on you following this plan. So how do you retain a sense of wholeness for the people that really just need an ear with the pressure of our profession saying you need to pathologize the heck out of these people?
Gosh, that's a great question. You know, I kind of see it as two-part. I mean, our original core program is not the medical model. It's, you know, we don't need a diagnosis. We don't need medical necessity to treat you. You know, our care is not reliant on a certain funding stream. It relies on altruism and the tribe, the elders of the tribe stepping up to say, we're going to take care of this space.
So the elders being all of us seasoned clinicians.
The seasoned clinicians, yes. Seasoned, I like that word a little bit better.
I can sit with that better.
Mm-hmm. So I would say there's that element, right? We have to preserve the idea that anybody can get access to approachable care that is not confined by sort of a medical model, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have to balance that with funding and the future, which mm-hmm. is why our agency at least took a look at, well, how could we process Senecal or Medi-Cal insurance so that we could be more sustainable or have more therapists on our rolls or have a center in Grover Beach or Santa Maria, et cetera? And finding out where do you lie in long-term, mid-term, or short-term therapy. Mm-hmm. I mean, our agency was founded originally on, you know, the short-term model, right? Because I think the cognitive behavioral therapy movement was sort of solidifying by the early 1970s and
Absolutely.
The 80s, right?
Right.
So
it was in response mm-hmm. to the laboriousness of psychoanalytic work that was taking too long
right.
to get people better. And also there was a switch of focus from looking at trying to fix the brokenness of people to trying to empower people to heal themselves, to look at their strengths.
Right, right. Which is great. I mean, the solution-focused mm-hmm. brief therapy model can do a lot of good, but it's not a one-size-fits-all. And I've had to learn that. You know, you take on a scope and a mission and, you know, you try to enact that, but you also see how it works in real time. So, you know, as the way we would approach that would be some clients really are in a 10 to 15 session model. And you can find that out from the beginning in terms of what they share about what they want to work on or what the goals are. And you're also going to run into clients that want to do more psychodynamic work, you know, the interpersonal development, the things that they want to explore, the depth that they want to go to. It's not 10 sessions. No. It's longer and you can't put a time limit on it.
Well, and I guess, you know, that's the whole idea of psychotherapy is, I guess, why we need to talk a little bit about the history. Because,
yeah.
you know, if we, let's say, use Freud as our starting point.
Mm-hmm, great. Late 19th century.
Yes. Uh-huh. And if you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is James Statler, who is the executive director of the Community Counseling Center. And we're talking about the history of psychotherapy and where we're going in the future. So let's start. We'll, there was stuff before Freud, but we'll use Freud yeah. as our starting point. And that psychoanalytic world
right.
and looking at the patient as being sick and going to a doctor because he's a psychiatrist mm-hmm. who would look at the symptoms and then try to fix what was sick about you.
Right.
And then we travel forward and a pushback to the psychoanalytic piece. And there's so much great history too, because most of his clients were women and he was treating them for what he called hysteria. Which was, if you looked at the social context of what was happening to women in the late 1800s, was they were living in these completely constrictive dresses, these constrictive gowns.
Sure, the corsets.
The corsets,
and all.
Thank you. That were not allowing them to breathe, and they weren't allowed education or access to their own financial well-being.
Right.
And we were coming into the age of enlightenment, but that's a whole Freud story. So the pushback, then we move into Carl Rogers and human-centered,
right.
the client-centered work of allowing the client to lead the path. And then what a lot of people don't talk about is World War II and the immigration of Viktor Frankl with
right.
logotherapy, which talked about finding a meaning in life because he had come out of living in the concentration camps and
right.
survived it and realized, you know, if we have a why for why we live, the rest of it won't mm-hmm. bother us, which opened the door to positive psychology down the road. And so I don't want to take the whole story, but so here's we're coming into the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Family systems starts to
right.
become part of the process. So you have Salvador Minuchin looking at family hierarchies and structures,
yes.
working with a lot of immigrant families who were moving to this country and their systems were falling apart.
Right.
So Salvador's trying to reintegrate family systems together with this very stringent hierarchy. And then we come into the social revolution of the 60s. And then counseling starts to lose a bit of its luster because of a lot of the, we didn't have a professional ethics that we had to follow. The don't have sex with your client law didn't come into effect until the 70s.
Right. Yeah.
Which a lot of people don't realize that there was kind of
there
was a lot of free for all in the 60s. And so what started is kind of the strong foundation of very people-centered, psyche-centered, wellness-centered gestalt therapy and human empowerment gets sidelined because we go into a very dark place of experimental therapies in the 60s. Right. And then, as you said, now the Community Counseling Center comes into play right as we have the soldiers returning from Vietnam and didn't have the support that the soldiers returning after World War II did.
Right. And I think if you look at Community Counseling Center, it almost threw its doors open to everything out there. Willing to treat addiction and willing to treat trauma. And, you know, since then, we've done a lot to sort of wrap our heads around a scope of work and where that person fits on the continuum. But, and some of that's good and some of that's bad. But I think as we look ahead, we're kind of rounding back around to the Carl Rogers person-centered approach. And we're seeing the humanistic, existential, you know, layers being pulled back. And you mentioned Viktor Frankl, but I mean, think of Rollo May was in that discussion as well.
Yes.
So.
Well, and think about if there was ever a time for existential angst, it would be right now. When people are really questioning what is the meaning of life and where are we going and how do I find some sense of foundation in a world that feels like it's crumbling underneath me. And that was exactly the period after World War II when Viktor Frankl and Rollo May were talking about this existential angst because the world had come undone at that time as well. And people were wondering, what is the meaning of this? How could man be so cruel to each other? And here we are again, kind of facing that same piece. And so I look at psychotherapy and I think, do we have enough clinicians who have been trained in that kind of thinking about the psyche? Or have we spent the last 30 years churning out clinicians that are following this medical model, cognitive behavioral, and they don't have the depth of training to go where the population's going? Mm. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. And Kathy, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. This is a good topic. It's a really sad one, but it's good to, you know, get it on the airwaves. My brother was in his 40s and is the father of four boys in grade school. And he's worked part-time. He's a stay-at-home dad. He did some volunteer work. He had lots of friends. He had a really good childhood and was a normal guy. He did have for a few years, he had a big sort of a rare health issue, and then he had a really excruciatingly, really painful divorce that he didn't want. And so over a few years, he had a really sad time, and he put on a good face most of the time. But apparently, he didn't see a therapist. I think for one thing, it wasn't maybe proposed in the right way or, you know, however it's talked about. We're not sure who or who didn't try to encourage that. But his primary care doctor prescribed a drug in the class of the benzodiazepines, which are like the most lethal type of drug out there, that class. And then my brother, for a few years, had some personality changes. He had really dark suicidal thoughts. He associated with the wrong person on the internet who was really super sad and ended up taking her life. And so he started associating with wrong things, like really dark music. And so the benzo he was on, like off and on for 1 to 2 years. And then he died of suicide. So so he had, you know, normal stressful reactions to life events, yet a doctor who wasn't even a psychology type doctor prescribed a very lethal type of drug to him, that eventually when a couple of things happened that were stressful, during this time, tipped my brother over the edge because his brain was fried, and that's what happened. So, unfortunate. That's only part of the story too, but I'll just say that.
No, and Kathy, I appreciate you calling because I can hear the grief in your voice, and I appreciate you sharing the story because your brother's story is not an aberration. It is the story that we're hearing over and over and over again, and why we have to keep talking about mental health and the continuum between psychotic breaks and the adjustment to normal stressors mm-hmm. of life. Because what you talk about, everything your brother experienced, were exactly what counseling was meant for, to help someone through a traumatic divorce, to help someone with the challenges of parenting, to help someone with health issues to cope and to build their resilience. And I am so sorry that he didn't get the care he needed. And I'm sorry that we've been too afraid as a profession to stand up to the medical world and say, you have to stop co-opting what are normal life stressors and create pathologies out of them because you're killing people. And I appreciate you calling in, because I think so many people need to hear that and to feel like there's a place like the community counseling center or a clinician or someone, a pastor. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago, we talked about the lay counselor, that for most people, it's even just a friendly ear next door mm-hmm. that can make the difference in someone's life. Just one person who will hear it and say, I see the pain and I hear your pain, that can make the difference in someone's life. Mm-hmm. And how do we simplify our life experiences instead of making everything large? I think that's our struggle. Mm. Thank you for calling, Kathy. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is James Statler. We're going to take a quick break and catch our breath and rejoin the conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, A Little More Todd. Barrett, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. That was actually Todd Rundgren singing with Daryl Hall at Daryl's house, if you want to listen further, A Want of a Nail. And my guest today is James Statler, and we're kind of having side conversations in between songs and conversations about the state of mental health services in not just our community, but in all over the country. And I think, to me, and tell me what you think, that the clash is between how we view a normal human psyche and how we apply treatment. That I feel like those two things are in conflict. That there's two, that the narrative of our cultural story is what's driving our sickness. Because the narrative of our cultural story is that we should be happy all the time. That people deserve to be happy, that we should always feel good, that nothing should get us down, and that should be our goal. But the reality is we experience death and sickness and grief and loss and trauma. That is the entirety of the human experience, with moments of joy and mm-hmm. pleasure and happiness. But because people have been told this cultural narrative that should always feel good, the moment things aren't good, they turn to something to fix it so they'll feel good. And that's where we're getting in trouble, because you can't just fix a broken heart. You can't just fix grief. You can't just fix a transition in someone's life. You have to live through things.
Absolutely. Well, we're not fixing, really, are we? I mean, we're practicing. We're practicing how to get all four phases, or however you want to see that. I mean, we're cyclical, right? I mean, there are phases of life that are the harvest, and there's phases of life where you're pruning, and there's phases of life where it looks like the fields are barren. And it's kind of coming around to that's part of the human experience, however you want to symbolically explain that. And we talk about it. We talk about the shadow and the dark part. I mean, and that's where the shame and the stigma comes in, though. I mean, a lot of our country is bottled or held back by the perception of weakness or just the fact that it can be hard to go there. I mean, it's hard to touch upon those spots in ourselves.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with the difficulty of touching into it, but I also want to stick to the piece of the stigma and the shame.
Yeah.
Because I do have an issue with our National Mental Health Organization. I think they perpetrate the stigma by trying to say all mental illness is a disease. And that you're mentally sick, because it's not a disease. The large majority of mental health issues are situational. And so our own National Mental Health Organization, NAMI, is the perpetrator of the stigma, from my perspective. And that if we stopped saying it's a disease and started saying, no, every person runs into times in their life where they need help, and that's normal.
Yeah.
You would not have enough clinicians to cover the people
true.
I need help.
It's true. Well, I mean, it kind of comes down to being honest then. Maybe we just need to say the dialogue or the narrative now shifts to any one of us at any time could have a need for mental health care. And that doesn't mean that we're diseased or that we fit into a medical model or we have labels or that we should sort of almost double down on our self-esteem issues because we've come forward. And also realize that there's this broad continuum. And I'm not all the way at the top of the staircase. I'm maybe at the bottom, but...
So you're talking about you're not in a psychotic disorder at the end.
Yeah.
You're at this very normal, large part of the continuum, which is life functionality struggles.
Adjustment. Yeah, right. What is it? Phase of life and adjustment to new circumstances in a new environment. Those create stressors for human beings.
And those are diagnoses in the DSM.
Yeah, they are.
They
meet medical necessity, don't they?
Absolutely. And the thing that's a struggle, of course, is that the DSM is a whole nother show, which started in 1952. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual was first published in 1952 as a way of weeding out those who would be good soldiers from those who would not be, which is why homosexuality was included in that original diagnosis of the DSM, because they didn't want homosexuals in the military. So then it becomes the book that all of our mental health and well-being is predicated upon. And in 1968, there were 106 diagnosis in the book, and the DSM-5, which we're operating from now, has 297. There's 297 ways people can be diagnosed as being mentally ill, which means that 50% of the population at any given time could have a diagnosis. That is not mental health or wellness. That's a book of disease, mm-hmm. model speak, that frightens people.
It does. You use the word pathologizing, but that's kind of what it comes down to. And I guess what you're flipping around is that sort of the medical model and the way that we tend to look to the extreme, psychosis, hospitalizations, in terms of where we need to pressure for treatment or funding, mm-hmm. is actually, it perpetuates the stigma itself, right? Because it gets everybody who's quote-unquote living normally to look at the system and go, oh my God, how scary. I never want to be a part of that.
Right. And so if someone says I have a mental illness, I immediately am going to be
lumped in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so why would I ever go for treatment? So our story, our professional narrative needs to switch. We need to have a kind of a different, we have to separate out a bit from the psychosis to the challenge of daily living, which is where the MFTs, which I am, psychotherapists, LCSWs, a licensed clinical social workers, the psychologists for a large part, that's our realm and domain. Mm-hmm. And the psychiatrists were dealing with the severely mentally ill. And I just feel we have to separate these two out, or we're not going to help people. And we'll have all of these young clinicians, as I mentioned before, coming out of training over the last 25 years who don't have the training in the depth work, mm-hmm. or looking at the contextual, why would it be normal for someone to have a trauma response to living through a hurricane? Because they lived through a hurricane. They don't need medication. They need to talk about living through a hurricane, mm-hmm. which is why we developed the human-centered approach after World War II. People need to talk about how do you live through that mm-hmm. atrocity? Doesn't mean you need medication. It means you live through an atrocity.
Yeah.
I don't know how to rebrand it. And mm-hmm. how do you rebrand it? Because you're kind of this place where all these young right. clinicians are coming in with very strong CBT, which is cognitive behavioral training and background, which looks at if we can change the way you think about a problem and behave around the problem, all will be well, which I love as a piece. Mm-hmm. I'd rather everyone CBT than take a med for right. anxiety, mm-hmm. especially, or phobias.
Mm-hmm.
But what about normalizing people's responses to life? Where is the normalizing of the human experience?
That's a great question. I mean, as I'm listening to you talk, I'm sort of gravitating toward, oh my goodness, this is really not, hey, I'm sick, I need help. This is really, I'm hungry, I want to live. You know, I want to tap into some transpersonal things. I want to tap into the spiritual psychology elements of my life so that I can have meaning, and that when I'm in struggle or I'm in grief, that I'm tethered to something.
Yes.
Yeah, right? And so...
And that you can feel like, although I'm in grief and pain, I'm not sick. I'm living just in a different... You know, Frankl talked
right.
about, even within suffering, there is meaning in life, because it means that you were attached to something that you're grieving the loss of.
It's so true. And, you know, maybe it's a cliche, but it's sort of... Even hovering. I mean, we all have to be able to evenly hover over the pain of life, you know, and not overly attached to a narrative of the end, right? A lot of us have that narrative of collapse. I mean, depression is collapse.
Okay.
It's sinking in, right? Mm-hmm. So what we want to be able to do is recognize that everybody can experience depression, you know, and the sinking in, but that you don't hit the bottom and the floor and hopelessness and despair. You actually are tethered to something greater, which is what a therapeutic relationship can do, right? Shows you the dimensions to connection and real rapport, and also hopefully helps you connect the dots about, you know, the archetypes or the stories in your life that will lead you towards meaning. And I don't think that everybody in our culture is really comfortable to step forward into that yet. It's almost like we're having the awakening about how important it is to do this work, but there's only a segment that's moving there.
Right, the stepping into the consciousness takes a lot of courage.
Yes.
Because it's not all pretty. But instead of wanting to kind of explore those deeper issues, what is the meaning of life? Is my lifestyle supporting my humanness? Should we be following these shiny objects of technology and our government and the story we're being told? Even though I feel uncomfortable and unwell in this lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's almost like the emperor's new clothes. Who are the people who are going to say, wait, this whole lifestyle narrative that we're living is making us sick. We're not sick. This story is sick. So how do we change it? But instead of getting encouragement to change our story, which takes a lot of work, we numb. So
yeah.
We have more video games, more screen time,
yep.
more binge watching. And again, I keep going back to Viktor Frankl. And if you haven't read Man's Search for Meaning, it is
seminal, right?
It is seminal. It's mm-hmm. life-changing, because this is a man who lived through the most horrific thing you can live through and came out with a sense of meaning and purpose and created a whole way of looking at the human experience called logotherapy in profound ways. And he talked about this is in the 1950s. He talked about the numbing and distraction and how people were working so hard to be happy that they were making themselves ill. Like, this isn't a new story.
It's true, right?
We think
Here's
it's just all modern,
itself,
right? We think right. it's all modern problems, but it's not.
No, I mean, it's sort of the cultural phenomenon, right? What we do when we're overloaded and asked to be on the stage of life, performing in the limelight all the time. This idea that our lives should be the story of a hero in the spotlight with success after success.
Always happy,
uh-huh.
no troubles.
You can never be distracted by something negative that you're, you know, you have, what is it, the panacea of technology is at your fingertips, right? Or the pill that, you know, you can go get. Those are there. But for those that are, you know, really hearing the knocking, there's other things to look at.
Yeah. And so I guess that moves us kind of into where do we go for the next 50 years? Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is James Statler. He's the Executive Director of Community Counseling Center here in San Luis Obispo. They're on Marsh Street. And their number is 543-7969 if you're interested in finding out more about their services. And our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to be part of the conversation. Where do you see us going with our mental health for the next 50 years? What will be those things that we're challenged with? Because we talked about in the 68 when you start, when not you, but when the CCC yes. started, it was the Vietnam War and the cultural changes and the family shifts that were really bringing people into mm-hmm. counseling. So where, James, do you see the need? What will be the functions of daily living that people struggle with from 2018 on out?
Well, I think an easy place to point to is going to be the social isolation that's happening, right? Folks are finding it harder to have connectedness with one another, right? The technology and the screen time is distracting. The long work hours, the worker identity that we all exist in, the desire to perform and have tangible resources to show our success are all going to be magnified, right? So, you know, our lives, the public part, the play, if you will, are on display. So, I mean, I think it's coming back to how are we going to get back to reconnecting? So,
to ourselves and to each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That'll be a key part of it.
I mean,
the anxiety that's out there, isn't it just sort of a big kind of anxiety quilt that we're all, you know, sort of trying to pull down the sheets or the covers on? I don't see that getting any better.
I wonder also about the climate change and environmental destruction and the mm-hmm. anxiety and fear and hopelessness that we see coming up connected with that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more, you know, and it's funny because I'm saying this out loud, but I'm thinking, but this was the story 50 years ago. You know, the things that we fear, mortality, the end of the world, the end of our relationships, the death of our children, all, those fears haven't changed. The things that drive people to anxiety or to depression, that hasn't changed. Maybe the circumstances have, mm-hmm. but the responses haven't.
You're kind of right about that. So I guess where do we leap forward, right? We have cognitive behavioral therapy. We have our mindfulness. We have our depth psychology. We've thrown the word eclecticism around before in terms of how do we cobble together the next lens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still human to human work. It's still vulnerability. It's still finding out, you know, who am I? How do I belong? What's my purpose? I mean, I think we still come back to those things. Mm-hmm. And also relieving people of the pressure that they can be what they want to be, right? Maybe that's the tone that's out there. The overtone is we can't be what we want to be, right? For various reasons. So we have to unpack that. Is that from childhood? Is that from trauma? Is that your own inner critic and voice that's holding you back?
Is that my social media profile that's making
me? Thank you. Yeah. Right. Is it that I didn't get enough likes? I didn't get enough comments? You know, I didn't get enough views on the website?
Because I think about who I'm seeing coming into my classrooms 10 years now at Cal Poly, I have a totally different student body, and the things that they're needing from me or the things that they're not capable of are changing dramatically. So I'm trying to push that down forward 50 years from now. You know, will we all have a comfort animal? Will we all not be able to take criticism? Well, you know, I think mm-hmm. what's really missing is that we have sucked the resilience out of this generation coming up behind us, that we've padded them so much. And so as clinicians, because remember, the clinicians, they've grown up in this culture as well. So will they have the resilience, the problem-solving skills?
Yeah.
You know, moving forward, will the clinicians that are at the heart of this profession be up to the tasks and challenge of trying to hold the foundation? And so you're 37.
I am.
So you're of that millennial group.
I am.
Group.
I know what you're talking about.
So just, and you're not a clinician either.
I'm not by training, no. My degrees are in history, and I cut my teeth in youth development with the Boys and Girls Club and mentoring, and that's kind of what opened my eyes to the psychotherapeutic world. But in terms of where my rooting is and what mental health is, it's relational, it's community based, it's service learning.
But as a 37-year-old millennial,
yeah.
What do you think about your group as a whole? How are they functioning and thriving?
Well, when I look at it, I think, you know, it's a mix of folks that were able to sort of transcend growing up in the computer sort of, you know, dot-com age where we live with screens. And then there are some that have lost their way, you know. They don't have the friendship and kinship networks. They've struggled to find a career or work that has meaning for them. You know, they're pausing on moving forward with relationships or family for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And so I see that. I think the greatest fear out there really is, you know, the way that we were taught to do things isn't what's required of us to survive and thrive, right? Because we, you know, still came out of the school systems with sort of, you know, this factory worker approach to, you know, be in your desk from 9 to 3. And we grew up with that anxiety of you got to show up every day from 9 to 3 and follow the rules and get the grades and get the GPA and get into the right school and land the career. And some have done that well and some are burned out and don't know which direction to turn because, you know, they sort of followed the script that was written for them, and now they're having to rewrite their script or not write it at all. Pill up,
yeah.
Medicaid up, you know, run, hide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's and it's funny because I hear you talking at the same time. I think as that one narrative starts to die out a bit, that mm-hmm. old draconian industrial
yeah.
revolution,
yes.
working the job, kind of my generation's do it for 35 years and retire.
Yes.
It is shifting and changing.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, there's the exciting piece of it, that it's wide open, that you can redefine. And so that's, you know, if we want to end with what are my hopes for my
yeah.
profession, the reluctant part of me says, oh, but I see a lot of hope if my yes. profession can churn out clinicians or the wise elders can help the millennials and who's coming up behind them and say, it's okay when things get torn down,
yeah.
as frightening as it is, it means there's space for growth. It means there's a reinvention. And you're at that place we were in 68. You know, 50 years later, you're in that place where you can make that choice of disrupting the norm and creating something sustainable and healthy and meaningful for you and your family.
Yeah.
Or you can kind of put your head down and Medicaid up and charge forward. But it's a moment of possibility and excitement. If we can, as a profession, as community resources, hold that space and say, this is a great time, as frightening as it is, this is a great time because social change doesn't come quietly. It comes with explosions.
Yes.
And if you can keep yourself together during the explosion, find that mentor, find that counselor, find that guide, your Yoda.
That's what it is, yes.
You can thrive.
Mm. So true. I mean, not to get personal, but boy, have I had to learn that lesson in the work that I've done. You know, those moments of doubt and do I fit? Am I good enough? And where do you go to? Go to other gurus, go to other mentors, get grounded a little bit and realize, oh my gosh, you know, I've got open field here to learn and grow.
It's about the fear, I think.
It is.
James Statler, thank you for being my guest today. This
pleasure.
Has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can find out more about me in my Facebook page. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org and get help at the Community Counseling Center on Marsh Street. Thank you for listening and supporting Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back next week to continue the conversation. Half of the time I can't decide it, half of the time I'm past.
and tomorrow. Try again tomorrow.